This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. And my co-host, Tom Vincenzo Giuseppe Bombasuto, is with me tonight. How are you, Thomas?
I'm doing great, Drew. I'm doing great. I was thinking just, the weather today is appropriate for our caller.
Yeah. Why do you say that?
Because
it's coming from England.
Because it's raining out, and when we think of England, I think of foggy, wet kind of weather. So.
There you go. Well, you never know. It could be perfectly sunny over there, but it's late. It's 11 o'clock at night, so I doubt it's sunny.
It's a little dark.
Yeah, I doubt it's sunny. Anyway, let's do a quick Drew's View, just a real simple one,
okay.
And that is if you don't understand history... history never repeats, but it does rhyme, and so you should better understand history if you're going to be an investor.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to talk tonight, and tell us what we're going to talk about, the book and the author, and he's one of the greatest historians on the topic of money. So,
the name of the book is War and Gold, and to your point about history, it's a 500-year history of empires, adventures, and debt. And Kwasi Kwarteng, he was born in London to Ghanaian parents in 1975, and he was educated at Trinity College, Cambridge, and at Harvard, where he spent a year as a Kennedy Scholar. And after completing his PhD in history at Cambridge, he worked as a financial analyst in London, and he is currently an MP. And that's not the military police, that's a member of parliament over there in England. So he's on the Conservative Party and has authored several books. One of them, which we're going to review tonight, is War and Gold.
Right. So, Kwasi, are you there?
Yeah, hi, how's it going?
Oh, we're doing fantastic. One thing before we get into your book, I just have to say that I love listening to Parliament debate. You guys know how to insult each other without them really understanding how badly you're insulting them.
Yeah, it's an old kind of convention. Because we obviously say, my honorable friend and all that. It's very courteous.
And then you courteously actually, insult them at the same time.
That's right, that's right. So you do it in quite a courteous way. Yeah. But actually, it can be quite rough and ready.
It is fascinating. I do love it. I love watching it and listening to it. Very different than American politics, though.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think it's much more cut and thrust because you can intervene a lot. It's very quick. It's quite quick, paced debate. And because we're sitting opposite each other.
Right.
The parties are sitting opposite each other.
Right.
And that makes it much more kind of engaging, as it were, because it's more confrontational.
So, Kwasi, we're talking about your book here, War and Gold, okay?
Yeah.
And so a lot of investors, our show is a financial show, and it's strictly educational. We want to teach our listeners about money from a strictly an objective educational point of view. And so we get a lot of people calling in and asking about gold. And when I saw your book, I thought, man, this is such a great history of money. This would be a great topic to bring into our listeners and help them to understand why gold has the allure that it has, but where is it headed now that we're in a fiat currency world? So that's the gist of why we wanted to talk to you today.
That's great. No, I mean, I think gold is very important. I mean, you can't understand the history of currencies or of money over the last, in the modern world. I mean, however you want to define the modern world, the last 300 years, the last 500 years, as I do in my book. But you can't understand that without knowing about gold and its role. And in fact, if you look at the history of gold, the striking thing is that it's only relatively recently, in 1971, that currencies, international currencies, like particularly the dollar and others, have been decoupled, have been removed, as it were, from any kind of gold underpinning. And that happened, as I said, in 1971. So for the hundreds of years before that, gold had some kind of role to play in the international financial monetary system.
But one of the interesting things that you point out in the book is that in 2010 or 11 or whatever, that despite the fact that we have a fiat currency where gold is not part of the monetary system, yet gold still has the same relative balance to world GDP, the value of gold to the world GDP. I found that fascinating.
It's interesting. I mean, I've got a table at the back of the book which looks at, if you look at the value of gold compared to the global economy, it's quite stable. Yes, there are big fluctuations, but it doesn't go massively out of kilter. It kind of is between, I don't know, 20 times and average about 10 times, the global GDP to the whole gold stock of the world. And I think, you know, there is a kind of sense to that because, as I said, it's a very tangible commodity. And in a world where you've got fiat currencies and instability, it does represent a store of value to a lot of people.
So do you have any understanding from your historical studies as to why gold? Why not copper? Why not silver? Why not oil? Why, you know what?
The traditional reason for it was that people felt that gold, I mean, had lots of qualities. And in the old Victorian political economy books, they would always say gold has durability. It's very malleable, so you can coin it. You can chop it up and coin it. It's quite soft. Obviously, it has a sort of physical allure in terms of the shininess. I mean, and that's quite, a kind of primitive response, if you like, to gold. But that it had that sort of lustrous quality. And it's not that heavy. And it's relatively rare. It's not something that's abundant. And so for all these reasons, it rapidly became a source of value. And if you look at other cultures, you look at Indian cultures, you look at Christian culture, from very, very early on, gold is a mark of value. So one of the things I point out often is that, you know, when we know that the nativity story, the birth of Christ, the three wise men brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, frankincense and myrrh aren't particularly well known, but gold, everyone understands what gold is. So even, you know, 2,000 years ago, gold had this very strong cultural value. And it's not just, in Christian traditions. You find it, you know, the Aztecs and the Incas. I mean, I talk a lot about Inca gold at the beginning of my book. They also had this sort of quasi-religious, put this religious value on gold. So it's always been across different cultures, across the ages, it's always been a symbol of value and wealth.
That is interesting that, you know, even cultures that weren't part of the Western culture, as we know, like the Incas, they still brought it in, and it had a store of value. But I only have about 15, you know, about a minute max before this first break, but I'm not allowed to call it a break, right, Tom? It's a pause.
You heard that. That's Big Ben.
Yeah. Listen.
Sorry, I just apologize for it.
Did we miss it? We missed it?
No, it's just gone. It's just gone.
Oh, but it rang, but we missed it, you know. So we were all listening so intently. Will it ring again at 6:30?
It will.
Okay, when we get to 6:30, we have to hear Big Ben before we're finished here. But anyway, what we want to talk about, Kwasi, when we come back is how this concept of gold has driven world economies, wars, government budgets, and so forth, and, just the military acquisition of gold and so forth, which you talk about in this book so brilliantly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the beginning of my book is the Inca conquest, the Spanish, what they call discovery of the New World. Of course, the New World was already there, but it's very Eurocentric.
Yeah.
This idea of the discovery of the New World, and the Spanish went over crossed 3,000 miles across the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, we're going to hold on this, right? We're going to hold. I'm going to come back in about 3 minutes, and we're going to get into the real gist of this and what it's all about. But right now, we got to go to Maggie Hunter and traffic, and we're going to be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. Take it away.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here, and our guest tonight, I have my co-host, Tom Bambasuto, and my guest tonight is Kwasi Kwarteng, and his book is War and Gold. Mm-hmm. And what we talked about, we were going to ask him at the break, is all the military conquest and the search for gold. And, he was talking about, biblical times and so forth.
Right.
You know, you look at the Bible, and there, every time there's a military battle, they're always taking the gold, but they're going looking for it. They're going looking for gold and silver. So, you know, Kwasi, why is it that, you know, these military conquests always seem to be in search of gold, even going back to biblical time, let alone 500 years ago?
Well, gold is critical because that's how you pay armies, because it was always a source of of wealth.
And that makes sense.
It had an international value. I mean, even in the, you were talking about biblical times, I mean, gold was something that was valued right across, you know, what we call the Middle East, in Egypt, in Sumeria, which is where Babylon, I suppose, Iraq, modern Iraq is, all through that region. You know, they coined, well, they didn't coin gold, but they traded in gold. And it was actually in Turkey where they started coining gold for the first time. And that's where the first coins come from, actually.
And so what they were looking for is they're looking for gold because that's how you played your military and that's how you increased your power and that's how you took more land.
That's right. So it was always a store of wealth and exchange, which is essentially what money should be. And of course, the association of gold with treasure, I mean, is still with us today, even though we don't have the monetary connection with gold that we used to have until relatively recently, 1971.
Now, when the conquistadors, right, the Spanish came into into the North America, let's just call it that, were they literally going here thinking maybe we can find gold there, or were they going for a different purpose and they just happened to stumble upon gold?
There were three reasons. Most historians would say there were three reasons why the Spanish were driven to travel thousands of miles across the Atlantic Ocean to seek sort of empire, if you like, in the Americas. And the three reasons were gold, they wanted money. Secondly, they wanted to promote their God. They wanted to expand Catholic Christianity and capture souls, if you like. And the third reason was glory. The three G's are God, gold, and glory.
Really?
That's how you know, we understand a lot of the motivation behind the fact that these people went thousands of miles from Spain into what they called the New World. Of course, it wasn't new for the Native Americans who were there, or the indigenous peoples like the Incas and the Aztecs in Mexico and Peru. But for them, it was a new world, and that's one of the reasons. Well, the three reasons: God, gold, and glory, were the reasons generally regarded as key.
Now, would that have been the same reason for your country, for the empires that it established?
Well, the British Empire was probably slightly different.
Much more civilized.
Well, I'm not sure it was. It was much more. It was later, but also it was more. It was probably more commercial. I mean, one of the things that the Spanish did in the New World was if you go to Mexico or Peru even, there are hundreds of churches that they built, and they colonized they lived in these communities. Whereas the British Empire was more trading. You know, the British, they built churches, but they didn't build so many. And the commercial element, one could argue, was always stronger, even than in the Spanish Empire.
So they were looking to grow tobacco, or didn't they have tobacco? What commerce were they looking for?
Well, the Spanish or the British?
The English.
The Brits were looking. I mean, there was initially the slave trade, but they abolished that, and then they were trading in spices, obviously from Asia. And in Africa, they got involved in some gold mining in southern Africa. There was gold mining in where my family come from, which was after all called the Gold Coast, which is now Ghana. But there were other crops as well. I mean, cocoa is very common across West Africa. Ivory, all sorts of goods were formed part of the trade, which the British promoted.
Okay, so here we are. We're coming along. These countries are coming in. Now, the Spanish start declining, and the French and the British are rising. And all of a sudden, the French and the British come up with this brilliant idea of, hey, you know, if we could come up with some kind of paper money, this will even better. And that's
well, the
when
paper the... money was a form of necessity. Because
why do you say that?
To do it. And I'm afraid the Americans were led the way. Because in the American War of Independence, if you remember, they printed money because they needed the money to pay armies and to pay for weapons, and they couldn't stick to the gold because they needed to expand the money supply, so they just went to the printing press.
So you're blaming it on us, eh?
Yeah, I am. I mean, the Continental.
Well, wait a minute. The South Sea Company and the Mississippi land purchase was before the Revolution.
That's true.
Come on, Kwasi, let's get back to that.
That was a slightly different scheme. I mean, that was a bubble.
But it was sort of.
They were trying to convert government debt into equity in these companies. So what happened was that Britain and France had these big government debts because they were fighting each other. And someone had the idea of getting all the government debt and essentially converting it into equity in the South Sea Company, so the people who'd bought bonds would become shareholders in a company that would be trading in the South Seas. That's the Atlantic and South America. And they thought that there was so much wealth in South America that instead of paying coupons, instead of paying interest to the bondholders, they could actually pay dividends, because the bondholders were now owners of the shares in this company. So it was a kind of primitive debt-to-equity swap.
And the French were using Louisiana in that area?
That's right. The French did the same. The French essentially copied the British scheme. Okay?
And they always do that kind of stuff, Kwasi.
they copied the British scheme. The British had the South Sea Company, and that was going to... So they converted... They wanted to convert government debt into shares in the South Sea Company. The French, under this brilliant Scotsman called John Law, who sort of ended up in France and supervised this scheme, his scheme was called the Mississippi Scheme, and it was a Mississippi company which would issue shares in exchange for the debt. So all the debt holders would become shareholders in the Mississippi Scheme. But, of course, there was huge speculation in the shares of the company, and unfortunately, the Mississippi company didn't make any money, because there were swamps. It was very inhospitable, the southern states at that time. They didn't have air conditioning. They didn't manage to make any money. And of course, the shares were being bid up as a sort of speculative bubble. And of course, in the end, the thing came crashing down, and the company didn't pay any dividends. So the whole scheme flopped.
How about South Sea? That got speculative too.
South Sea, very similar thing happened. Again, the South Sea bubble was just after the Mississippi bubble, even though the French had copied the British scheme. What happened was that they started trading shares in the South Sea Company, and that company had been trading for about 10 years. But then in 1720 there was a huge bubble. There was a huge bubble in the shares, and of course they came crashing down. They went up about 15, 20 times, and then they came crashing down.
So did the South Sea Company actually make money for people?
No, it didn't make that much money at all.
So neither the Mississippi deal or the South Sea deal made really any money for anyone?
No, because the whole point of it was that they were going to try and, because they thought they had huge profits, they could make huge profits in South America and in the Americas generally, they thought that these dividends would come pouring in. They made some money, but the dividends never justified the huge prices, the astronomical prices that people paid for some of the shares. Can you hear that?
Yeah, we did. I hear it.
Did you hear that?
I did.
We did.
I did.
That was Big Ben.
That was Big Ben, man.
Wow.
I'll tell you.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
That's pretty cool.
That's great. So, yeah, I mean, so that was the South Sea bubble and the Mississippi scheme.
Okay, so we're going to have to stop on this one. We're going to take another pause. But before we do, don't go too fast on me, Anna Carolina. Tom wants to read you a little thing. This is what we're going to talk about in a second. Go ahead, Tom, read that.
Yeah, page 29, the modern advocates of quantitative easing, whereby a central bank prints more money to sustain economic activity, are the intellectual descendants of John Law, who... Maybe they should make a movie about, based on your description.
We're going to talk about that when we come back, Kwasi, because this gets into the whole point of what your book's about. And now we're going to go to Maggie Hunter and traffic, and we're going to be right back, Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Kwasi Kwarteng, who is an MP in the British Parliament, or the United Kingdom Parliament, I guess you would call it. And I guess that was very comforting to see Scotland vote to stay part of the United Kingdom, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was a bit of a relief. I mean, it was incredible that it was actually as close as it was, because obviously in America, as I know well, you have to have two-thirds, you have to have super majorities, really, to change the Constitution. Whereas this was just a straight up and down, you know, 50% vote.
Right.
Yes. So,
and we have our Scotland. We have Texas.
You have to. It's harder to change the Constitution though than over there.
Yeah, but Texas claims that they kept the right to leave the Union if they want. That's their argument.
Okay.
So
okay. So that is like Scotland. They can just vote.
They can. That's what they say. Now nobody knows whether that's true or not, and I don't know that Texas wants to try it at this point. Anyway, Kwasi, let's get back to the book. Tom read a great quote that you had in there, the quante visioning, or the intellectual descendants of John Law. And one of the beauties of what your book is all about is that, you know, basically money is all about figuring out how we can have more of it, which in essence then brings on debt, which what you just talked about, which is what they did with the South Sea Company and the Mississippi Land Purchase Company. And you know, debt is just more money that they can have. And then debt causes the real problems in the economy. And so, you know, I'm kind of rambling here, but go ahead. You take it from here.
The connection between debt and paper money is pretty obvious, because both of them are a way of conjuring money out of nothing, really. So when the government borrows however many trillion dollars it needs to, essentially that money is just being printed, in the sense that it's not real. It has no real tangibility. It's just essentially they press a button and then they put the money into the bank's balance sheets, and that's how it's constructed. And debt is very intangible like that. And what I was saying in my book is that gold is the opposite of that. Gold is tangible. It's real. You get it out of the ground. So, you know, when you look at how wars are financed, a lot of the time, I mean, I have to bring it back also to the American Revolutionary Wars, the War of Independence. You know, that was funded by printing money. And the French Revolution as well. During the French Revolution, when they started fighting other European countries, Napoleon, well, before the rise of Napoleon, they printed money. They printed paper money. And also for our experience in Britain in the First World War, we suspended the gold standard, and we borrowed lots of money. We borrowed billions of pounds, and that was the same thing. And also in the Second World War, we borrowed lots of money. We always borrow money, essentially, for government purposes, and mostly to fight wars. And the same thing happened in these recent wars that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan. We borrowed money, your country, our country, my country, borrowed money to finance those wars. So this kind of triangle, this dance between gold and paper money and debt is all very, it's quite well connected. And what I'm saying in the book is that, you know, sound money is often put at peril with these wars.
Now, though, nowadays, though, it's not just war that we spend this money on. We spend it on government programs. That's right.
So this is how this period is slightly different, because in the past, government spending, paper money, talked about the American Civil War, the American Revolutionary Wars, the Wars of Independence, the World War One, World War Two. These were all actual wars, you know, military engagements, which often lasted much longer and cost much more than people thought at the beginning. But today, because of the welfare state that we've built in much of the Western world, in all the Western world, we have these huge liabilities, these amounts of money that we have to spend. And one of the ways that we do this, because we can't raise enough money in taxation, is we borrow. We borrow and print money in order to keep our almost an addiction to you know, the kind of entitlements that we have.
Well, you know, one of the beauty of democracy is democracy and freedom and
That's
so
right.
forth. But one of the dangers of democracy, and we've opened up Pandora's box to it, is that government can do things for you, and so the people vote and say, "Hey, I'd like more of that."
It's not a problem if governments do things for you if they can cover their costs. So if the tax base and the tax revenues can cover this expenditure, there isn't a problem with that.
Well, to some degree, though, but wouldn't you say, in my opinion, you always have to be very careful as a government to take.
Oh, absolutely.
And then give.
In the British Parliament, I'm a huge spending hawk. Absolutely. But what I can't bear, so I don't like too much government spending, but I particularly hate it when they're borrowing to spend the money.
I understand. That makes sense.
And I have discussions with German colleagues, they're German MPs, I suppose. They're in the German Parliament, and they always say they praise the welfare state. And I said, look, I mean, I said to these people, at least they balance the budget in Germany. I mean, it's pretty near balanced.
Wow.
Whereas in my country, and certainly in France and in the U.S., we've been running deficits for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different debate if you're actually managing to balance the books.
Well,
obviously, in an ideal world, I don't think we should be spending that much at all, because I think it drives out private investment.
Since you're so close to the Eurozone, we really want to ask this question, because we're really afraid that the Eurozone is a Gordian knot that's going to be the only way it's going to be untied is the same way the last Gordian knot was untied. It's just going to have to be chopped up. And if it is, that's going to be a danger for the world. Do you believe that's possibly true?
I think what people have underestimated around the world, and certainly in Britain, is the extent to which the powers in Europe, particularly the Germans, to a lesser degree the French, are completely committed to this thing. I mean, it's a political project. They really, really want this thing to work. And ultimately, I don't think they're just going to sit by and watch countries just leave the euro. These guys are very committed to that single currency. And the extent to which it's a political project and has a lot of political force behind it is not really often appreciated by foreign investors.
But the only way it can possibly work is if they become the United States of Europe, and they'll never do that. In other words, if they collectively take the debt in and handle it accordingly and handle everybody's budget.
That's the problem that they're trying to resolve. So either they're going to get closer political union, or, as you say, the thing will have to come apart. But they haven't realized that yet. They still remain very committed. If you speak to, see, that's Big Ben again.
There we go. You're 1 second behind us.
It starts a bit before the actual time. But look, I mean, if you speak to German politicians and bankers, they still remain very committed to the single currency project, and they will try and do whatever it takes to keep that show on the road. And I think that lots of people around Europe are very bought into the euro. I mean, the Greeks would have regarded it as a national disaster if they had to leave. And so their elites, all the elites around Europe who are in the eurozone, are very committed to keeping it on the road.
Yeah. So, Kwasi, you got to hold on with us. We've got to take our final pause of the night, and then we're going to come back and wrap up on war and gold, and we're going to talk about the outcome of where you think fiat money is headed to in the future. And right now, I got to go to Mark Thibodeau and weather. We'll be right back. Money, Rich, Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
We're back from Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're with Kwasi Kwarteng, and he wrote the book, War and Gold. And as I said at the beginning of the show, if you're an investor and you're not studying history of money, history of markets, and things of that sort, you're making a major mistake, because history doesn't repeat, but it clearly rhymes. Mm-hmm. And what Kwasi's pointing out in this book is how often people manipulate money to borrow more money, which ends up in disaster.
Yep.
And we want to get into that topic, but before we do, Kwasi, we want to just ask you an interesting little question. What are your thoughts toward this little weird thing that's now come about called Bitcoin?
Bitcoin, I think, is fascinating. I mean, in a way, what I find interesting about Bitcoin as a historian is that it's clearly come about because people aren't that happy with the fiat currencies that we've got now.
But it's a fiat currency, if not worse.
It is, but it's the interesting thing about it is that it doesn't have It's not pretending to be what it isn't. It's not saying you've got some mighty state backing it. It's a much more amorphous thing. It's going away, the kind of the ultimate expression of it. But what is phony about our fiat currencies at the moment is that they've got this kind of air of authority, you know, the mighty dollar, the weight of the United States behind it. But it's still only paper money. So I suppose Bitcoin is kind of getting rid of all the kind of the national, the kind of the hype, if you like, the sense that there's something solid behind it, and saying, look, this is a virtual currency. This is what it is. This is what money ultimately is.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mark Andreessen just came out the other day and said, we can recreate the whole financial system with something like Bitcoin. Would you think a country like England or the United States would consider that a threat to the financial systems?
Yeah, they definitely would. I mean, there are issues to do with, you know, I suppose cybersecurity and the kind of the internet and that kind of virtual world, all of that stuff. Because it's based on software, right? So, you know, anything that's based on software has a vulnerability in terms of, you know, cyber attacks and stuff like that. So
right.
there would be concern about that.
So go
yeah,
ahead.
I was going to say, but you know, it's kind of like the one world currency. I mean, that's what Bitcoin could do. But you know, the military.
Yeah, but at least it's not trying to impose itself. I mean,
right.
I mean, as a free market person, someone who likes the free market, I'm not that unhappy. I mean, I welcome people if people think, right, we can set up a currency. And of course, if it's a good currency, people will use it a lot. And it might drive out other currencies. If it's a bad currency and it's not, then it'll be driven out itself. You know, the good money driving out the bad money. And I think we've got, in this world that we live in, I think we've got to be be quite tolerant and inclusive, if you like, of different ideas of this kind.
Now, we only have about 5 minutes left, Kwasi. It's actually only 4.5 minutes left. And so let's get to the conclusion of your book. Your conclusion of your book, if I read it right, is you say that governments around the world ultimately aren't going to be able to repay the debt. Did I read that right?
I think that's right. I mean, either they're going to default or they're going to use inflation to get rid of the debt. Or, when we see it now, they're going to use what some economists call fiscal repression. Well, that's a fancy term. But all it means is that you have very low interest rates and you essentially force investors to swallow up very low interest rates. And that's how you kind of finance yourself.
Which is what Japan has done.
Yeah, I mean, if you're very much in debt, the idea of a market is that the more indebted you are, the more you're going to have to pay to get more debt. So a very bad credit will pay a high interest rate. A very good credit will pay a lower interest rate, a much lower interest rate. And that's how the market is meant to work. Whereas now you've got situations where, as you say, like Japan, they've got huge debts, but of course the interest rates are very, very low that they pay on the debts. And that's what these economists have come up with, the term fiscal repression. They're essentially forcing the investor, forcing people who hold their debt, to swallow very low interest rates.
But a large portion of the Japanese debt is held by the Japanese central bank.
That's right. I mean, a large portion of that, which is almost like which is QE, a form of QE. Mm-hmm. And also their problem is that it isn't as acute as others because it's held by the Japanese public ultimately. I mean, the problem is you get very big problems when you look at a country like Greece, for example, where the debt of Greece was held by German, French, Italian banks, international asset management companies. And that's where you get a problem, because these guys can withhold their funds. They can effectively go on strike, and therefore your interest rates will be forced up, and you have what we call a funding crisis. They can't actually raise the debt they need, and that's when the whole kind of bailout, sovereign bailout, as we call it in the Eurozone. That's where that comes into play.
You know, one of the interesting things about the markets right now, and they're acting kind of funny, especially in Europe, where the stock market went down 3% today, is I think that investors are getting a little concerned that maybe central banks don't have the omniscient power that they thought they had.
No, I mean, I think because we've tried lots of different things during this crisis. I mean, the crisis broke in 2008, which is 6 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done all this QE. We've done huge amounts of, you know, we've bailed out banks, we've bailed out some businesses, we've bailed out countries in the Eurozone. And still, there isn't that much sense that we've actually solved the underlying problems. Deficits, in many cases, are still very high. You only have to look at France to see that. The financial situation in Europe, in terms of the banks, is still very precarious. They have huge bloated balance sheets, these banks, with very uncertain sort of loans out there, which don't look as if they'll be repaid. And as I say, government debt across the Eurozone and in Britain is very high. And after all this time, 6 years, in fact, we still don't seem to be near a kind of stable situation. And if you throw into that mix, you know, the global situation with people like ISIS and this Ebola scare and all the rest of it, you can see why markets are taking a big hit right now.
So, Kwasi, we only have 30 seconds left. How much of a person's portfolio would you put into gold right now? 5%, 50%? No percent.
No, I would always try and keep between sort of maybe 10%, 10, 15 is a bit conservative, 10% as a kind of insurance. But I would sort of hedge that with against sort of equities. I wouldn't necessarily buy bonds or keep my money in cash.
Huh. Well, Kwasi, I really appreciate it. And you stayed up pretty late sitting around listening
midnight.
To Big Ben
yeah.
with us. But we really appreciate your time with us.
No, it was fun. I always stay up pretty late.
Okay, well, I don't. I usually go to bed very early.
Okay, good for you.
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
okay.
War and Gold, Kwasi Kwarteng. I recommend it to everyone. You need to know the history of money. Anyway, again, Kwasi, we really appreciate your time. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.